Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Monday, February the 10th, and we'll be doing two public hearings today. One on the portion of House Bill 5026 that relates to the Oregon Board of Dentistry, and another one on the portion of House Bill 5026 that relates to the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and we'll combine that with a public hearing on 5038, which is the fee bill for the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I'll open a public hearing on the Oregon Board of Dentistry and invite Ms. Jones from the Legislative Fiscal Office to take us through her summary.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in front of you, you'll have the LFO analysis as well as the presentation for the Board of Dentistry.
Uh-huh, I know.
And a presentation from Budget and Management. The governor's recommended budget for the Board of Dentistry was a 7% increase over the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget. The board's revenue is 100% other funds. There were no budget notes from last session, no audit reports within the last 2 years, and no interim reports or studies were completed within the last 2 years.
Questions or comments on Ms. Jones' presentation? Moving right along here, we would invite Dr. Short and Ms. Bones to come forward, along with Mr. Patton from BAM. And anyone else who would like to come forward is welcome to do so.
Packed Monday morning. Couldn't bring Bones because of dentistry.
Oh, good point. Dental floss
and donuts. That's a fluoride treatment before we get that, you know.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please proceed with your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Dr. Ronald Short from Klamath Falls, and I am the Vice President and a three-year member of the Oregon Board of Dentistry. I will give you a kind of a brief rundown of the board, and then Mrs. Joanne Bones, who is our executive director, will continue. The Board of Dentistry is one of the older state agencies. It was organized in 1887 to regulate the practice of dentistry. In 1946, dental hygiene was added to the purvey of the board. The mission of the Board of Dentistry is to assure that the citizens of the state receive the highest possible quality of dental care. Its identified goal is to protect the public from unsafe, incompetent, or fraudulent practitioners, encourage licensees to practice safely and competently in the best interest of their patients, and to educate the public on acceptable and appropriate dental practices. The statutes also require that the board adopt and enforce rules regulating the administration of general anesthesia and conscious sedation in dental offices and to regulate the services provided by dental assistants. There are 9 members appointed to the Board of Dentistry and 7 permanent full-time staff in our office. The 9-member board includes 6 dentists, one of whom is a specialist, 2 dental hygienists, and 1 public member. Members of the board are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. As a board, we meet every 8 weeks to conduct the business of the board, and at least once a year, we have a planning and strategic retreat. Much of the work done during these sessions involves review and modification of our strategic plan. Communications and consumer protection are the board's highest priority activities. This is reflected in the board's performance measures, which will be discussed later by Mrs. Bones. The board utilizes the services of many contracted dental consultants to provide expertise and also dental specialists who assist the board in conducting dental specialty examinations. There are 6 advisory committees: the anesthesia, dental hygiene, communications, enforcement standards, licensing, Standards and Competency, and the Rules Overview Committee. We have representatives of the various stakeholders, the Oregon Dental Association, the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association, the Oregon Dental Assistants Association, as members of these committees. We have an excellent working relationship with the School of Dentistry and all of the professional associations. In 1999, a dental summit was organized, which meets four times a year and includes the members of the Board of Dentistry, representatives from the Oregon Dental Association, and from the dental school. One of the primary goals of the Board of Dentistry is to improve access to dental care for Oregonians. We've been an active participant in early childhood caries prevention projects, which are involved with fluoride varnishes and fluoride treatments and early dental health risk assessments of children. Our board was a founding member of the Oregon Health Workforce Project, a first-of-its-kind effort in Oregon to quantify the supply side of the health care delivery systems. This project is coordinated by the OHSU, the Oregon Health Sciences University, area health education centers, and ultimately resulted in workforce reports regarding physicians, registered nurses, dentists, dental hygienists, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and pharmacists. Our executive director, Mr. Bones, has served on the steering committee for the Healthcare Sector Employment Initiative, a project of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. This project explored the issue of the projected critical shortages in certain healthcare professions and developed strategies to address this crisis. This past year, we have also worked on legislation regarding the ownership and revision and updating of the anesthesia rules and regulations. I was the board representative on the ownership committee, and there were members from the Oregon Dental Association, several of the group dental clinics, and so on. And we achieved consensus on the majority of the issues that were brought before that committee regarding ownership of dental practices. The board is also active in licensing at the national and regional level. Two members of the board, one dentist and one dental hygienist, and the board's executive director act as liaison and voting members of the American Association of Dental Examiners. The American Association of Dental Examiners is comprised of state members of state dental boards, dental educators, board administrators, and board attorneys. Its focus is on the development of licensing and examination standards for dentists and dental hygienists. We also appoint members of the American Dental Association Council on Dental Education, Commission on Dental Accreditation, which is responsible for the evaluation and accreditation of dental education programs, and of the Joint Commission on National Dental Examinations, which conducts standardized written dental and dental hygiene examinations, which are recognized by all 50 states. Our board executive director is also an active member of the American Association of Dental Administrators and recently completed a year as president of that organization. We have board members, both past and present, who work for the Western Regional Exam Board, which conducts clinical examinations of dentists and dental hygienists. The board is funded primarily by licensees. For budget purposes, the board is one operational unit. Major activities are licensing and examination, enforcement and compliance, and the administration of such. There's a graph on page 57 in your notebook which alludes to that. The board works very closely with other professional associations, including the Oregon Dental Association, the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association, and the Oregon Dental Assistants Association, to assure that our licensees have an active voice in the processes of the board. There are approximately 3,500 licensed dentists and 3,200 licensed dental hygienists in the state. We anticipate in the next biennium issuing about 700 new licenses, which is probably going to be equally divided between dentists and hygienists, and which would be about a 39% increase over what we've had in the past. This increase, though, will not translate into that large an increase in practicing dentists and hygienists, because we are also at the point where there are many dentists and hygienists at the age of retirement. We offer licensure through examination, by credentials, and for dental specialists, the ability to be examined by the board in their particular specialty. But their license is then limited to that area of specialty. Applicants for a general dental license or a dental hygiene license must pass a written exam called the National Board, which is conducted by the American Dental Association, its Commission on Dental Education. Applicants must also pass a clinical examination conducted by either the Western Regional Examining Board or by the Central Regional Dental Testing Service. Candidates who pass either of these two clinical exams may apply for licensure in about 30 states. Mrs. Bones will now proceed.
Any questions? Just proceed.
Are there questions or comments? Please proceed.
Good morning. I'm Joanne Bones, Executive Director for the Board. I'm going to go through the more detailed issue of our programs. There are no major budgetary issues for this biennium. Our fees were last increased in July of 1999. And we have no proposals for budget increases through the 2003-2005 biennium. We also have no budget-related policy legislation. As Dr. Short mentioned, we have three major program areas, which I will touch on. Please stop me if you want to ask any questions. In our licensing and examining section, we license dentists, dental hygienists. We conduct examinations for eight different specialties. The specialties are listed in the footnote on the bottom of page 3. We issue four levels of anesthesia permits in accordance with our regulations on establishing standards for the use of anesthesia in the dental office. We also certify dental assistants to provide particular types of expanded functions like taking x-rays. In the licensing process, we conduct background checks on all of our new applicants. And Dr. Short already talked about the examination process. We conduct audits of 15% of our licensees who are renewing for compliance with our continuing education requirements. In the enforcement and monitoring section, we investigate complaints that are filed with us. There's a law that requires that we conduct complaints on any formal complaint that's filed with the board. The count that's on this particular page, page 4, is only for 2002, but there is more information under Exhibit C in the back of this document. We also conduct investigation based on malpractice claims that are required to be submitted to us by insurance companies. Most of the complaints that we receive are alleging unacceptable patient care, but there's a broad spectrum of issues that people do file complaints about. Those are also detailed on Appendix Item C1.
I could not find in your presentation information anywhere a breakdown on the nature, categorizing the complaints and telling us which ones you're getting, which area you're getting the most complaints in. Is it possible to put together some kind of display for the committee about what we're always interested in, where the bulk of the complaints are coming in what area, and then looking over time at how successfully you're being able to address those issues?
Madam Chair, it's in your supplemental material that I brought in this morning. I'm sorry it's not in the back of your book. It's in your supplemental material. I apologize. I'm a little nervous.
It's somewhere in the stuff that we just got.
I know, well, we've got...
We were going to fix your books this morning, but some of you had taken your books home over the weekend, so we didn't have a chance to insert the new pages. Does that answer your question, Madam Chair?
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair?
Senator Messerly.
I'm having trouble getting rolling this morning, I guess. I'm in C at the back of the red.
It's in the additional.
It's in a separate packet that's underneath of this book. Oh. Or maybe to the right there. It was in the paper pile that was on your desk this morning.
Okay.
Now, move off to the pile on the right there and see if it's in
there. No, I think it should have been under this. Here we go. Got it. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Disciplinary actions are reported to the National Practitioners Data Bank by federal law and to the Health Care Integrity and Protection Data Bank. We also check these data banks when we're looking into the background of an applicant who's been licensed in another state. This gives us information as to whether or not there's been any actions that we need to be aware of. Licensees who are under disciplinary sanction by the board are actively monitored by one of our investigative staff to ensure compliance with the terms of their order, especially our licensees who have substance abuse issues and are in recovery or treatment programs. There are usually 45 to 50 licensees who are being monitored on a regular basis. Not all of those, of course, have substance abuse issues. Some of them are just being monitored to see that they complete their continuing education, their community service, they pay the restitution or their civil penalty or whatever it is that they've been required to do in their disciplinary action. As I stated, that chart right in the middle of the page are the actions that we dealt with in 2002. But there's more information, again, in that supplemental material that's marked C2 that talks about the types of disciplinary sanctions that have been ordered by the board for the past 7 years.
Can I back up a little bit here and go back into the spreadsheet that talks about case investigations opened by type? And you have one called applicant issues, which is 4.7%, almost 5% of the complaints you receive.
Mm-hmm.
What is applicant issues?
Madam Chair, those wouldn't be complaints, but they're investigations that we conduct based on some matter in the past history of an applicant who's applying for a license. Either they've had an arrest record that they need to report to us, or if they've been licensed in another state, they have been disciplined, perhaps, and it's information that we need the background information about in order for the board to make a decision as to whether or not they're considered suitable for practicing safely in Oregon.
And then you have another one that is almost 8%, that's no apparent jurisdiction. Can you talk to us about what that category involves?
Madam Chair, no apparent jurisdiction are just what it sounds like. It's a complaint that's received by us where somebody is complaining about something that occurred between them and either a dentist or a dental hygienist that is not within the purview of the Dental Practice Act. For instance, they might be complaining that the office manager was very rude to them, or the dentist wouldn't give them appointment in a timely manner, They we had a complaint recently about somebody who slipped and fell in a parking lot, and the dentist refused to acknowledge that his insurance company might have some responsibility. That's not anything over which we have any jurisdiction. And we, by the law, because they're a complaint, we have to open an investigative file, do a summary investigative report, but our recommendation to the board is close no apparent jurisdiction. Because we have not done an investigation, we just call it no apparent jurisdiction.
So then the no apparent jurisdiction complaints are really unacceptable patient care complaints, but they're outside of the jurisdiction of the board? Is that what's going on?
No, ma'am. They're not unacceptable patient care. They're issues over which somebody has filed a complaint with the board, but it doesn't fall within the Dental Practice Act.
Okay.
Somebody had an altercation in a parking lot. The dentist was, or the staff was rude to the patient. Somebody had to wait too long. Their insurance didn't pay as much as the doctor's office estimated that the insurance company would. We actually don't have jurisdiction over those, but there's a law, 676, was passed by the 97 legislature that says that if we receive a complaint, we must open that complaint as an investigation. So we count those, but they'd have no applicability within our statutes.
And then unacceptable patient care. I was probably going through all these papers when you talked about what... I'm just curious if you could recap what the process is to investigate these, and if people are found to be practicing unacceptable patient care, what you do to try to mediate or mitigate for that.
Madam Chair, many of these do involve issues where the patient is concerned about the type of care that they received in their dental treatment. It might be that the dentist pulled the wrong tooth, or a denture broke within a couple of years, or the denture never fit, or the orthodontia treatment that the child went through for 4 years wasn't successful. There's also incidences of bad fillings, undiagnosed caries, undiagnosed periodontal disease that went on for years and years. When the board sees those types of issues, the investigation involves our investigator getting the patient records, going through the patient records, looking to see what a reasonable dentist would have done, and trying to make a determination whether or not this is something that no reasonable dentist would have done. The dentist is interviewed, any subsequent or prior treating dentists are interviewed, and the patient is interviewed. All of that information is put into a report and given to the board with a recommendation by the staff. And the board has available to them at the time that they review this information the case file, including the patient records. And Dr. Short can speak to any of this if you just want to jump in.
You're doing fine.
So the board looks at these and then makes a decision as to what is a reasonable reaction to this. Is this something, is this a history of continued unacceptable, just really, really bad dentistry where, you know, the fillings are just really big, mushy, nasty-looking things? I'm not a dentist, so I can't speak.
I am.
I've seen some pictures.
Same thing.
Or is it just something where and I'm going to speak about dentists because most of this has to do with dentistry, not dental hygiene. Or is it something that can be remediated? A high percentage of what the board ends up doing is asking the dentist to take a little bit of remedial education. It might be that it's just record keeping. And when it came down to it, the treatment was okay, but what the dentist didn't do was keep really good records. But we have plenty of instances where the dentist is ordered to get some continuing education in diagnosis and treatment planning, in perio, in, can you think of any? Crown and Bridge. Crown and Bridge is a big one. That's, it's a big complaint area, because anything that's a substitute for a natural structure is difficult to make fit in a natural way.
What happens if you see a continuing history of patient complaints about an individual?
Well, the remediation gets steeper. There might be a suspension, there might be fines, there needs, we have had a case not too long ago where we decided the dentist could probably bring themselves back to an acceptable level. After all, they were practicing acceptable dentistry at some point when they graduated and were examined, and we instituted a series of office reviews where our dental investigator, who is a dentist, and one of our contract dental investigators visited this dentist's office on a regular basis about every 3 months, invited one of the patients to come in, and they reviewed with the dentist the work that was being done and went through some charts to see improvement, and they did in fact see improvement, and the probation was lifted.
If I was looking for a dentist, and is there anywhere where I can go to access the information about who has had issues with quality of care?
Disciplinary actions are public record, and you need to call our office with a specific name. If you ask us, we will tell you whether or not there's been disciplinary action, and we will provide for you a copy of the what is public record. A long history of lots of complaints, however, with no disciplinary action is not public record. So you can get the information by calling the board office.
Senator Mesley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it would be helpful if you could break out the complaints from the dentist and for the dental hygienist. Is it possible to do that? I think we'd get a clearer picture of exactly what we're dealing with.
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, I can tell you right off the top of my head, maybe three of these have to do with dental hygienists.
Mm. Okay.
And they're probably not patient care issues.
Okay. Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, thank you. I've kind of written out a few questions I'd like to ask just real quickly, and I don't require a long answer to them. I just want some quick comments from you that relate to the topics we're talking about right now. One is that in this list of investigations under narcotics and substance abuse, you have a very low number of individuals being looked at here. In the professions, unfortunately, because of the stress of job or whatever, there usually is a larger number than this. And I'm wondering if you have an open program for dentists to apply to if they're having difficulty. And if you think this is a real number as far as the number of dentists out there that might be having difficulty with substance abuse and narcotic abuse.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I agree with you. It's a very low number, and I don't think we're seeing anything like the tip of the iceberg. The statistics are much higher for the health professions, as you know, especially those who have access to drugs. The Board of Dentistry does not have a diversion program such as the Pharmacy Board, Board of Medical Examiners, and the Nursing Board. But there is a well-being committee at the Oregon Dental Association that is available to any licensed dentist. And that process is confidential. We believe a higher percentage certainly is turning themselves in, self-reporting to the well-being committee. The ones that usually come to our attention are not self-reported. They're reported by either a patient, a supervisor, or a staff member.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I would ask that if, I don't want names, obviously, give me an idea if you can, maybe in your next report, the number of dentists turning themselves into the wellness program, because that would be the figure I'd be looking for to see if you really have an active and functioning program. So you probably have a lot more than 5 or 6 people a year using that program. If you keep records on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, the Oregon Dental Association's well-being process is confidential, and I've not been privy to that information. I certainly relay your request to the Oregon Dental Association to answer your question. Would that be satisfactory?
The other questions that I have relating this is Is medical, or not medical, is dental malpractice becoming an issue for dentists at all? Are their malpractice rates going up as other professionals are?
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, from my own personal experience, my insurance premiums have not risen that much, not to the extent that that the medical premiums have. I am in a little different situation. I retired in March of 2001, though, so I'm a little out of the loop. My policy premiums may reflect the fact that I'm not actively practicing at this point in time. I have heard the usual complaints that I have heard over the years about insurance premiums being too high, but I've not heard of any major crisis at this point in time, but I can't give you a very accurate opinion other than just that.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Commonly working emergency rooms a great deal, the biggest complaints I get concerning dentists are coverage of practice after hours and weekends. The dentists are not available to take care of their patients after nights and weekends. And a large degree of dental pain that patients seem to have is not adequately covered by dentists. Does the board get many complaints along those lines, or am I an outlier because I work in emergency rooms? Have you had complaints from patients to the board concerning dental pain and not being able to get a hold of dentists nights and weekends?
I can recall several complaints over the past 3 years that I've been in, that I've been on the board, but I don't recall that as being a major problem. Do you have any statistics on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we don't have any specific statistics on that. We do have a rule that requires that dentists have provide backup for emergency care, and once in a while when we do get a complaint, it's because the backup failed.
Have you ever had follow-up, Madam Chair? Mm-hmm. Have you ever had complaints from emergency room physicians or physicians that backup for dental care is not available?
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, I cannot recall such a complaint. Can you recall?
Neither can I. Not from the physicians.
Would you like a form to fill out?
I'd like a form to fill out. I can give you one about once a week. About once a week. All right. That would be 52 a year from one doc. Okay. Right.
And that's in Southern Oregon.
So obviously that's not being captured and not being followed, okay? All right, so thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Vesely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On your category of work without a license, could you expand on that? Is this people whose license has lapsed or who are coming into the communities and operating without a license?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, it's a little bit of both, but it's more the first than the latter. It's more somebody who has either allowed their own license to lapse and continue to work with a lapsed license, or somebody who's allowed the super, a combination of both, the dentist who is responsible, so the dentist let an unlicensed hygienist continue to work. A few. Once in a while, we get a new applicant waiting for the license, gets a little anxious, has performed dentistry without a license. Those who are absolutely unlicensed and not even qualified for licensure aren't dealt with necessarily in our complaint process. We've had a few in the minority populations. We had a Russian dentist and a Mexican, person performing dentistry. Those are we usually try to deal with through the law enforcement and agencies.
Hello, Madam Chair.
Yes.
You just brought to mind another question. Are these complaints that you've documented, are they from the public, or do you also include complaints from your own office? Or investigations or complaints that come from within your office?
Madam Chair, Senator Messler, yes, it's a combination of both. It's complaints we receive from the public. The board has the authority to open complaints on its own motion, and the malpractice claims that we receive from the insurance companies. Primarily, however, they're from patients, the highest percentage.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
I believe I'm at the top of page 5, administration. Our administrative activities include implementation of board policy, communication efforts, collaboration with other associations, the dental school, the educational programs, other related licensing agencies, such as the boards of pharmacy, medical examiners, denture technology. We do all the things most administrative portions do. We work on legislative activities. We track our budget. We do the purchasing. We do contracting. I write all the materials for the website, most of the materials for the newsletter, try to keep those going, and we do quite a bit of, well, as much as we can, personal appearances. We speak to the dental school a couple of times a year and various study clubs and other groups as we're invited. Our performance measures for the agency, we have 3 goals and 5 measures. The documentation from the DAS, the Performance Review Committee, is at item D in your presentation document, not in your supplementary material. The board's number one goal, of course, is public protection. We want to protect the public by assuring that all licensees are competent and safe to practice. We have 3 measures under that goal, including compliance with the continuing education, turnaround times on issuing licenses, and turnaround time on conducting our investigations.
In the performance measure that deals with the turnaround time on the issuance of license, does that also include the background check in that period of time?
Madam Chair, no. That's the fingerprint card is part of that, and our completion time for the turnaround in the investigation has to do with completed paperwork. Completed paperwork includes getting the fingerprint card back from the state police. So once that's in, it does take anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay, so just so that I've got some clarity on the process here, someone that was applying for a license then would, before the clock starts ticking, the background check and all the paperwork has to be completed. And then your measurement is from that point until their license is in the mail to them?
Yes, ma'am.
How long does it take to complete the background checks?
The background check with the National Practitioners Data Bank and the Health Integrity and Protection Data Banks is about a 24-hour turnaround. We do a computer inquiry, and they send us back an electronic inquiry within about 24 hours. Background.
Does that go through the state police?
No. It's direct. It's a direct internet access to the federal reporting data banks. It's the fingerprint card that's through the state police, and that takes 2 to 3 weeks. June is a hard time for the state police to turn around the fingerprint cards because there's so many applicants for a lot of licensing boards applying at the same time. That's the extent of our background check, unless it's one of our problem applicants that where we require getting court documents or police records.
So if you got back from your background check that there were some issues, then I would assume that that particular application would be taken out of the system at that point, and you'd go into some kind of subsystem to check out the issues that were brought forward.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. That's one of those cases that then becomes a number in the case investigations opened by type under applicant issues. They're issues that need further research, and then those are issues also where the board has not delegated to staff the authority to make a final licensing decision. We take those to the board for a final decision.
And then those applications that have subsequent issues aren't included in this measurement that's here. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Please,
thank you.
Can I interrupt since we're talking about licenses? Thank you. I see here on page 30 of your budget narrative, about a third of your licenses are out of state. And then on page 32 is a breakdown of the licenses. Now, do you charge the same for a person who is practicing out of state as you do one in state?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, yes, we do.
Why?
Because it, as long as it's maintained as an active license, we find that it costs us the same amount of money to keep the record maintained within our office. These people are still required to do their continuing education, and we have to maintain the files of many people who live out of state. For instance, they might live in Vancouver, work in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
They may live in Boise and work in Ontario.
No, I was just thinking it should be higher.
Higher?
Well, I mean, if a licensee is out of state and there's value in having an Oregon license, I mean, is there value in having an Oregon license if you're out of state?
We certainly think so. There may be. It provides their mobility.
Well, you know, this may be comparing a case of apples to oranges, but we had another board come before you, the Naturopath Board, and it's very much that case that the Naturopath College here in Oregon has a national reputation, so there are a lot of out-of-state licensees. Also, if a person is hunting or fishing and they need an out-of-state license, that's almost double. If I were to go out-of-state and buy a license, or if an out-of-state person was coming to Oregon to buy an out-of-state hunting or fishing license, and the reason for that is because they're using the natural resources and the goodness and the wholeness of the state of Oregon. And so there's a value put on that. So that may be something of consideration the board might want to take
in. Has the board ever discussed the issue of having a differential rate for out-of-state?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I appreciate your comments. They're unique. Yes, Madam Chair, the board has considered, about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, the board considered having a lower fee for an inactive license and decided, for the reasons I stated, to keep them the same as an active license because it costs us as an agency the same to keep them active.
But I'm not talking inactive. You know, I'm talking out of state. Right. Maybe they have a dual license and a double accreditation, maybe something that is valuable to their practice, or if they're at a university or something, it could be of good value to them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not maybe a monetary value, but a blue sky value, something like that. So I think that's something that needs to be taken into consideration, Madam Chair, with all of our licensing boards. You know, I think this issue can come up a lot. We certainly shouldn't charge less for out-of-state licensees. We should at least charge the same, if not more. That's just my opinion.
Would it be possible for you to break out your out-of-state licensees from the in-state licensees so we can see what percentage...
There, Madam Chair, there's a graphic in your...
on page 30?
That's what you were talking about.
Yeah, it's right here, 30. Oh, and I have a follow-up question, too.
Since okay.
Okay, on page 30, the very last line, it says you get revenues from civil penalties, blah, 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 and the sale of mailing lists. What kind of mailing lists do you sell?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the licensees' names and addresses are public record for all... licensing boards, and insurance companies and various people doing mailings call and ask or write and ask for the mailing list, and they can get it on a disc or on labels.
Yeah, okay, and that's something that you're provided to do. You are required to do, beg your pardon.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, yes.
Okay, I was just curious. Thank you.
Well, yeah.
Just don't send my name out.
Madam Chair, thank you. On the issue of out-of-state licensing, I think what we're trying to get to is those dentists and others that are licensed out-of-state and practice out-of-state. We're not, I don't think, particularly interested in people out-of-state who practice in-state, like what case you've talked about, dentists living in Walla Walla and practicing in Pendleton and so on and so forth. So I don't think that's the concern. The concern is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is dentists who live out-of-state, practice out-of-state, and the only... next stand with us, they can maintain a license here in the state.
Correct.
Okay. And that's something that it is done elsewhere. I know several physicians, as an example, who live in Oregon and have a regular practice in New Hampshire. They fly back for 2 weeks at a time and come back for 2 weeks. They'd rather live in Oregon than live in New Hampshire, but they have their practice in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. Sounds bizarre, but it happens.
Wow.
Okay.
Doctors,
yeah. Yeah, doctors are crazy, so me being one of them. Okay, but that's, I think, what we're trying to get to.
Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Bates, for that clarification.
Please proceed.
Thank you. I believe I stopped at excellent communications being our second goal. The board believes that with good communications, it can educate its licensees and the public as to what expectations are and should be. And we've been working especially hard with those communications in the last few years, primarily with our newsletter, our speaking engagements, and our website. We did post user surveys on our website about 6 months ago. We don't have enough results from them to find out whether or not it's going to be an effective means of measuring our communications activities. Most of our comments are quite positive, but as I said, they're still inconclusive. Our third goal is to set standards that are regulated in a fair and objective manner and support a positive business environment. We utilize the expertise and the interest of the professional associations and all of the board's decision-making in those regards. The board's strategic business plan is also detailed in our budget document. It includes the 4 points that are here on page 6, that to assure that licensees are qualified and competent to practice safely, promoting access to oral health care. The board is working on that primarily through looking at the scopes of practice for dental hygienists and dental assistants so that they can provide more patient services and free up the time of dentists to do more deeper levels of dentistry. The standards of practice, statutes, regulations are realistic, understandable, and applied appropriately, and that the communications are timely and useful. We haven't had very much in the way of program changes in the last few years. Licensure by credential is one of our biggest ones that it has actually made quite a difference. We have, since we implemented licensure by credential, sort of like mid-2001, and then opened it up even more in late 2000, early 2002, we've licensed 105 dentists and 63 hygienists through licensure by credential, which are licensees who wouldn't be here if we didn't have this pathway. Limited access permit dental hygienists is another. It was a major move as far as moving into access to care. It's hygienists who can provide hygiene services without the supervision of a dentist in limited access settings such as nursing homes, homes for the developmentally disabled, and then the last legislative session, schools settings and Job Corps type sites and prisons were added to that scope of practice. We still don't have a lot of limited access practice hygienists, but there's a lot of interest in it now that they can more work with children than geriatrics. Both are very important.
Senator Gordon.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't want to cut you off in mid-sentence.
That's fine, Senator.
Thank you. I wanted to ask at this point about the November emergency board decision, which had the effect of removing the dental benefit from the Oregon Health Plan. And I know that one of your projects, at least from the content of your report here, says that you've been an active participant in the Early Childhood Caries Prevention Project coordinated by the Oregon Health Plan. Could you talk to us about the impact and consequences of removal of that dental benefit from a policy standpoint and then also from a budget standpoint? I mean, your expertise could provide some guidance to us.
Representative Morgan, Senator Gordley, I'm afraid I'm not as up on the budget issues for the Oregon Medical Assistance Programs. It's my understanding there were 300 to 400,000 people covered on the Oregon Health Plan dental. That's a significant piece of our population. Excuse me, I'm going to get emotional about this, who will not be able to access dental care. Dental care is a primary piece of our health, and I think Dr. Short could probably speak to that better than I can. We expect at the board level to be receiving more inquiries from people looking for dental care who don't have insurance or can't afford to private pay. We haven't quite seen it yet. Prevention is just a big, big piece of good dental health. What can I say? I'm sure you've heard it in other venues.
Madam Chair, we're having a little sidebar conversation here.
I think Dr. Short wanted to respond, but we were waiting for your conversation.
Oh, Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, in regards to the adult dental or dental in general under the Oregon Health Plan, I think that it is very unfortunate that that program has been discontinued. A lot of people have received a lot of dental care. And with that program discontinued, we probably will see an increase in the emergency room problems, which was the main thing before the program was put into care. We're going to see people that have gone from something that could be fixed at minimal cost to something that's going to require a lot of money to fix. Representative Bates has probably seen what happens with acute dental infections. They can be a life-threatening situation and can cost an awful lot of money. So I think that somewhere along the wise, why we're penny-wise and pound-foolish, so to speak, I would really like to have seen the dental care continue.
Mm-hmm. If I might just add a level of clarity, Representative Bates, can you talk about the categorical and non-categorical dental benefits as they relate to the Oregon Health Plan a little bit?
I will put the caveat in that if I'm an error on this, I'll correct my error later. My understanding, my memory of it is that adult dental has been a part of the expansion plan that we've had for people who are non-categorical. Categoricals are those people below a certain level of poverty, pregnant women, and children. Those are considered categories by the federal government that must be covered under Medicaid in order to get your Medicaid match. The problem for dental care for the categoricals is it's not a mandate by the federal government, but strongly recommended. And the problem for those people often also is because of low reimbursement rates that they have a difficult time getting into dental offices because rates are so low. There have been programs set up under the expansion plan that covers both them and the new expansion, which is the adult dental, primarily through dental managed plans across the state, which have been very successful and dealing with a lot of people. The loss that we're looking at right now is a loss of adult dental, primarily for the expansion population, those outside the categoricals. Those people will be probably going to emergency rooms now when they have dental problems, which are usually tooth abscesses and infections of the face resulting from this. They will have dental loss, lose teeth, which actually makes it difficult for them to get jobs, surprisingly. There was a study done that people who have a lot of teeth missing actually have a difficult time getting even the simplest of jobs sometimes. And, of course, there's nutrition problems and other problems associated with this dental loss. So I think that's probably what we're talking about here. And it is, a situation where if we don't do the preventive care in all parts of these programs, we're going to be paying more costs later on down the line. But it's a problem not just unique to dentistry. It's a problem we're trying to deal with in a more global sense with the entire Medicaid population and the uninsured population in the state. So I hope that shed some light, but I hope I didn't confuse anybody. It is a difficult situation.
Well, and I might add to the discussion, because my understanding of the situation does concur with your explanation, that during either, I can't even remember which special session it was, the second or the third special session, the dentist stepped forward with a plan to significantly cut the reimbursement rates for dentists that allowed us to maintain the coverage through a longer period of time than we would have been able to. We did run into some problems with the way that the legislation was structured, in that we, for the first time, took the legislature into the area where we were setting the level of care rather than the commission that's supposed to oversee that part of the Oregon Health Plan. So there was some angst in that department. But I do think that we should acknowledge that the dentists were a huge part of those discussions. You stepped up to the plate and you got the job done. And we still ended up having that ultimately cut the service to the non-categoricals, the adults covered by the program.
If I might add something, Madam Chair, the programs have been set up to take care of those people. The structure of them may be lost also, and that's a real concern for us. Once that structure is lost, to rebuild is going to be difficult, because you've put together managed care plans with a private dentist and others that may be well lost. Which leads me to one last question, as I have to go to the committee right now. Does the board have a position on ownership of dental practices? Does the board have a position on the ownership of dental practices? Or have you chosen not to take a position, which I would understand? I would point out that I can't seem to find a dentist on nights and weekends, but they've certainly found me on this topic with no trouble. My emails are filling up.
Representative Bates, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, yes, the board certainly does have a position on ownership of dental practices. I've just handed Dr. Short the bullet points of what the board's positions are. Dr. Short served on the task force. However, the task force legislation doesn't cover everything that the board is supporting. We'd be glad to either supply this to you, or we could just read it right now.
This might be something that's not of great interest to the rest of the members of the committee. I'd like to look at it later with you. Okay.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were at major program changes. We had just mentioned limited access permit dental hygienists. The only other major program change, it's a major program change probably only to me, but we were able to add a position to the board, a staff in 1999. This is an investigator who helps us with the background checks on applicants and monitoring, in addition to helping with the investigation backlog, which we're finally getting a little bit of a handle on. Our cost controls, coordination, and administrative cost ratios, we're a small agency, we're very conservative. All of our purchases are carefully reviewed. We don't buy it if we don't need it. We buy it cheap if we have to buy it. We follow all the purchasing guidelines and use the cost control purchasing contracting that's set in place by the Department of Administrative Services. If I have to buy file cabinets, I go to a used office furniture place on Sandy Boulevard in Portland, or I go to City Liquidators, since I'm not in Salem, for the surplus property. We just really carefully look at all we do. We utilize the services of internal structures as much as we can. Our bulk mailings, printing of our newsletter are done by the Department of Administrative Services. We also use the services of Inside Oregon Industries quite a bit for bulk mailings also, and I really respect the quality of the furniture that they make, and when we buy new furniture, it's from them, though we haven't had any new furniture since we bought our new investigator. I estimate that 1.25 FTE of our 7-person staff is devoted to administrative duties, so that's about 17-18%, something like that. I don't honestly know how that compares with other agencies, but I don't see how it could be very much less. We still intermingle all of our jobs every day, so it's really hard to put a hard and fast number on that. The next item is our information technology. We have a small standalone local area network that consists of a file server, eight computer workstations, two printers. Our investigators also use scanners and digital photography to copy and store information, including...
Yes, I could interject. We have a whole other board to do this morning and only until 10:30 to accomplish that.
Okay.
So if I could ask you to kind of expedite...
Where do we want to go? Straight to the decision packages?
Pardon me?
Where would you like to go?
Well, I know that Senator Gordley is interested in Senate Bill 786, so perhaps we could spend some time discussing that aspect.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just say that I have taken some moments to read the report since I've been sitting here, and just want to commend you for a very thorough assessment analysis of opportunities for the Board of Dentistry, including opportunities to recruit membership for your board. Also, I think your survey of the workforce and its current location is very instructive to us. I would ask members to look for a moment on page 3 to see where primary practices are currently located, and again where some of the gaps in service exist, certainly in our rural communities. Eastern region jumps out at me. But again, Madam Chair, just to be brief, this is an excellent report and a great start under Senate Bill 786, and I commend the board and its membership for the work that's going forward.
I would have to add that I think this is one of the more complete reports that we've seen on the Senate bill. Senator Mesley.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have two questions. First of all, do you have any vacancies in your staff at this time?
Representative Morgan, Senator Mesley, no, there are no current vacancies, so my position will be vacant soon.
I hope not because of this board. Madam Chair, second question.
Go ahead.
I think you have an ending balance that would cover your costs for about 9 months, and it's been growing at the rate of about $80,000 to $90,000 per biennium. Could you speak to that? Is that adequate, more than adequate? And maybe Bam will want to comment on that later, too.
Representative Morgan, Senator Messler, yes, it's an adequate ending balance. By my calculations, I believe it's more like 7 months ending balance, but it's grown a little bit faster than anticipated because last legislative session, the legislature passed a bill that put into place licensure by credential that was more more expansive than what the board had adopted, and so we gained some licensees since the inception of that statute where the revenue was not part of our anticipated revenue stream. So it's just a little higher. That's probably one of the reasons we won't need a fee increase through 2005.
Thank you.
The I think looking over the budget issues, the only you're not asking for a fee increase. All the other policy packages appear to be funding fairly routine things, with the exception of the request for the investigators. Do you have anything that you'd like to add on either the computer package or the investigator package?
Madam Chair, I point out that the computer package is to pay for a new network server. Our current server is slower than some of the stations it's serving, and sometime by 2004 or so, we'll need to replace it. Every couple of weeks, we have a big bog down, and we have to reset the system. It's just for some things like an Ethernet switch. I can't even tell you what an Ethernet switch is. Mail server software and some memory upgrades. It's pretty minor. Stuff for a system that keeps us in business every day. the issue of the investigators. These are dentist investigators who work for us for $34 an hour. We've been able in the past year to be able to do what I'm asking for here because we had some salary savings, unfortunately, due to a long-term medical leave of an employee. And it has actually helped us catch up with that backlog. We no longer have shelf space that wide full of case files waiting for an investigator to get to them. We've only got two or three, and it's really helped since you saw in our statistics that the vast majority of our cases are unacceptable patient care. It really helps to have a dentist looking at them. What I'm asking for in this package is to double the number of hours that we can afford for that type of work.
If there are no further questions or comments from the committee, I'm going to move over to Mr. Patton from BAM to do the overview, BAM's overview of the budget.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Patton with Department of Administrative Services. You should have my presentation in front of you. I'll try and go over it here pretty quickly. If you go ahead and turn to page 2, you'll see the budget contains $1,770,506 other funds and 7 positions. This is about a 7% increase over the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget. Page 3 shows that the board's 100% other funds. Page 4 shows that the board continues the current level of services to its licensees and citizens, also provides some enhancement package for computer upgrades, increased investigator and consultant services. There are no new fees or fee increases. Page 5 shows that the board is one program unit. Page 6 is a breakup of personal services, services and supplies. As you can see, personal services is about 57% of the board's budget. Services and supplies about 43%. Page 7 is a building blocks for the governor's budget. The board did not attend any emergency boards through November 2002. There was a compensation plan adjustment during the third special session. Package 010 contains standard inflation for temporary appointments and a decrease in mass transit tax. There was a program adjustment for package 020. This package removed limitation that was awarded for an increase in board member per diem. This was from last session. House Bill 2250 contains some language for the increase, but the bill was never passed by the legislature. Page 7, first package is the inflation package. This package includes 3.5% inflation for all services and supplies. The only exception to that is a 5.3% inflation rate for facilities rent due to increased costs for the board. Package 131 is the excess on top of the package 030 for facilities rent since the building's rent is higher for next biennium. Package 132 replaces the network server and the new Ethernet switch as stated by the board. Package 133 increases investigator and consultant services from 16 hours to 32 hours per week. The only technical adjustment is the elimination of the impact of American increases.
Questions or comments? Senator Mazzaro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeremy, what is the requirement for ending balances? In my mind, I'm thinking that we require a three-month ending balance, and at what point do we get concerned that there's too much reserve?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, usually it is about 3 months, but Ways and Means in 1999 did tell the board they wanted them to hold about 6 months ending balance just because of their licensee structure. And I believe they can get most of their revenues in March, it is. So they do want them to have a higher than normal ending balance.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments from the committee? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a little bit far afield, but a number of our boards and such have ending balances and certainly have the ability to raise a little bit of money. And I wonder if any of the boards talk about supporting, I know under current law they all go back into the board to run the board, but supporting things like pediatric dentistry in the case of the Board of Dentistry, and either programs for children or maybe supporting OHSU's pediatric dentistry school, which now is they're not teaching anymore. And whether it might be something for us to think about in the future.
Thank you. Further questions? Well, I'd like to then dismiss this panel, and we have Jane Myers, who wishes to come forward and testify on, does not wish to come forward and testify. That's not you. She's not here. Well, we have no one. Ah, thank you. This is a statement from Jane Myers, who's Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Dental Association. It says, the members of the Oregon Dental Association pay fees to the Board of Dentistry, and we support the expenditure limitation in House Bill 5026. The ODA notes particularly the support for the money for investigation efforts and believes it will help the board meet its enforcement mission. And this will be made a permanent part of the record of the proceedings today. And having no further questions or comments for this committee, I'll close this public hearing. And not before thanking you, Mr. Short, for the volunteer time that you put in on these issues. We very much appreciate you being a part of it.
Thank you.
And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5026 and House Bill 5038 that relate to the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
We will begin with Ms. Jones from the Legislative Fiscal Office taking us through her summary of the budget. Ms. Jones.
For the record, my name is Cindy Jones with Legislative Fiscal. Chairman Morgan, members of the committee. Attached or in front of you, you have my presentation for the Legislative Fiscal Office. Although there's two supplements to the binder book for the Mortuary Board and the BAM analyst presentation. The governor's recommended budget for the Mortuary Board was a 10% increase over the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget. It's 100% other funds. There were no audits completed. No interim reports or studies were completed within the last 2 years. Within the budget, there is a fee increase. In the 2001 legislature directed the board to establish administratively a yearly renewal fee of $25 for pre-need salespersons during the 01-03 biennium. The process of raising fees needs to be ratified by the 2003-2005 legislature. Also, Senate Bill 347 has been introduced that this budget relies on to raise the death certificate filing fee from $7 to $14. If the fee is increased, it will generate $315,021 other fund revenue for 03-05.
Why do they want to double their fees?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think that Mr. Coe will be able to answer that question in his presentation.
Questions or comments on the LFO overview? We have Mr. Garcia and Mr. Coe, please, and Jeremy stays there. Please take it away.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. My name is Michael Garcia, and I'm a licensed funeral service practitioner and embalmer here in the state of Oregon. Also one of the owners of City View Funeral Home, Cemetery, and Crematory here in Salem. I've been on the Oregon Mortuary Cemetery Board for about 6 years, appointed by Governor Kitzhaber, and I am the board's current secretary-treasurer. And with me today, to my left, is Mr. David Coe. He's been with the Mortuary Board almost 7 years and currently serves as the executive director for that organization. First, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to tell you about the board, and after briefly describing the board's mission and composition, I will let Mr. Coe give you more information about the board's budget presentation. The mission of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board is to protect public health, safety, and welfare by fairly and efficiently performing its licensing, inspection, and enforcement duties, by promoting professional behavior and standards in all facets of the Oregon death care industry, and also by maintaining constructive relationships with licensees and those they serve and others with an interest in the board's activities. The board is composed of 11 members appointed by the governor, two funeral service practitioners, one embalmer, two cemetery representatives, one crematory representative, and four public members. And the board has a full-time staff of six individuals, the executive director, a compliance manager, two investigators, one office manager, and a licensing specialist. Again, thank you for the opportunity to come before you to present our information about enhancing our budget. Thank you.
Questions or comments for Mr. Garcia? Mr. Coe.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is David Coe. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. There are approximately 60,000 deaths in Oregon each biennium. The board's programs affect those who have suffered a loss, those who make final arrangements, and those who provide goods and services associated with the end of life. Final arrangements can be made in two different ways, at need or pre-need. At-need arrangements are those made at the time of death. Pre-need arrangements are those made in advance during a person's lifetime. The Mortuary and Cemetery Board regulates the practice of both individuals and facilities. Individuals regulated by the board include funeral directors, embalmers, pre-need salespeople, apprentices, and interns. Facilities regulated by the board include funeral homes, immediate disposition companies, cemeteries, and crematories. In 2002, the board had about 2,200 licenses in effect. Roughly 1,450 of those were issued to individuals and 750 to facilities. I thought it might be you might be interested to know that the regulatory scheme in Oregon is somewhat unique in the so-called death care industry. Unlike Oregon, most states continue to regulate the various components of the death care industry separately. Oregon's combined funeral, cemetery, and crematory oversight cuts costs and reduces overlapping regulation. Some locations, like Mr. Garcia's facilities, include a funeral home, a cemetery, and a crematory. During a recent inspection tour, one of the board's investigators was able to inspect all three at the same time. In addition to reducing the board's inspection costs, that sort of efficiency minimizes interference with the conduct of business. Oregon's unified board also eliminates the turf battles that sometimes plague funeral and cemetery boards in other states. The Oregon plan also increases consumer protection. When concerns arise, consumers can bring their complaints to just one agency that has the authority and the expertise to examine all aspects of funeral arrangements. Consumer protection is also enhanced in other ways in Oregon. Nationally, licensing boards are sometimes criticized for being so industry-dominated that they cannot truly protect the public. There's no basis for such criticism in Oregon. In addition to having members that represent the various industry components, the board has four public members, and staff members are prohibited from actively engaging in any regulated practice. None of the board's staff members have ever been employed in the death care industry. My plan was to talk with you a little bit about the board's goals and performance measures and also about Senate Bill 786, but in view of Representative Smith's question, perhaps you would like me to go directly to the issue of why the board is requesting a fee increase. The fee increase, the board's plan for the fee increase is contained in policy package number 171.
Okay, where is that?
Policy package 171
oh,
may
got
be
it.
Found in your...
Got
okay.
It.
In order to continue the board's public protection activities at the current level, the board would be facing a deficit of about $40,000 by the end of the 03-05 biennium. That would leave the board without any cash balance, and I believe budget and management recommends that the board carry a 3 to 6 month cash balance. This revenue shortfall has been anticipated by the legislature since 1999. when the subcommittee recommended that the board review its fee schedule to determine whether a fee increase was necessary. During the 2001 session, the board came back and reported to the education subcommittee that although expenditures were expected to exceed revenues, the board's cash balance was sufficient to absorb the difference. The subcommittee, the education subcommittee in the 2001 session observed, however, that the board would probably need a fee increase for the 03-05 biennium. The board receives no general fund, lottery fund, or federal fund revenue. The board's programs are solely supported by other fund revenue derived from two principal sources, a variety of license fees and a portion of the death certificate filing fee. License fees were last increased in 1993. The death certificate filing fee was established at $5 during the 1985 legislative session. It was intended to provide revenue for the board to implement a number of major reforms passed in the wake of the Amsberg incident. Some of you may recall that in 1984, a funeral director by the name of Dale Amsberg in Lincoln City was found to have horribly neglected and abused quite a number of human remains in Lincoln City. And I'd be happy to drill down on the details there if you'd like, but it was a watershed incident in Oregon that resulted in the complete transformation of Oregon's regulatory scheme. And getting back to that unique regulatory scheme in Oregon, it was the point in time when the board assumed responsibility for regulating cemeteries and crematories and all sorts of other reforms. During the 1993 legislative session, a second death certificate filing fee...
Mr. Coe?
Yes.
May I stop you just for a moment? Representative March has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry to interrupt. I guess the question I had, we don't have a breakdown of your other fees for, i.e., funeral service practitioner, embalmer, apprentice, funeral establishments, etc. So I guess the question that I came up with from my perspective is, I mean, we're doubling the filing fee for a death certificate, and did you consider maybe moving that up $3 to $10, which is a nice round number and sounds like a filing fee to me, that rather than 14, and look at taking the rest of the revenue and spreading it across a small license increase in those other categories?
We did indeed look at a range of options for increasing the death certificate filing fee. When the board looked at that spreadsheet, the board concluded that looking to the future, it would be best if the fee increase would be sufficient so that net expenditures would meet revenue, so that by net expenditures or net revenue, what I mean is revenue that would be derived from the fee increase and not including the $2 that is transferred out to the Department of Human Services for the Indigent Burial Fund and not including the cash balance. We also considered the prospect of raising licensing fees. While Oregon's combined regulatory scheme has many advantages in terms of efficiency and cost savings and consumer protection, one of the disadvantages has to do with establishing fees and attempting to make a determination as to how much of the fee burden each component of the industry should bear. The board allocates its resources according to issues that may affect one particular component of the industry and not another at a given time, and it's a moving target and very difficult to establish what a fair distribution of the fee burden might be. It's also subject to opinion, and we have obviously various groups represented on the board and various professional associations and so on. When the board looked at that, it seemed apparent that the best way to determine a fair distribution for the allocation of the fee burden would be to arrive at a point where all of the board's licensees were somewhat unhappy with the outcome. And if everybody was sort of equally unhappy, then we would have felt as though we did a fair job. The board, in evaluating how a fee increase should be structured, the board put together a fee structure advisory committee that was composed of those who represent the funeral side of the industry, the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, the Cemetery Association, and the Funeral Consumer Alliance, which is a 12,000-member group of consumers. We also had some representatives from large corporations involved in a fee structure advisory committee. The fee structure advisory committee met several times. Board members were invited to participate, but did not. But this committee met several times to come up with a recommendation for the board as to how a fee increase should be structured in the event a fee increase was necessary. The recommendation of the fee structure advisory committee was to raise the death certificate filing fee, and they listed four separate reasons for their recommendation. The first was that the death registration filing fee was established for the express purpose of providing revenue for the board to carry out its responsibilities. Second, the $5 portion of the death registration filing fee had not been raised since the fee was first established in 1985. Third, with an estimated 60,000 deaths per biennium, increasing the death registration filing fee could produce considerable revenue without significantly increasing the overall cost of final disposition for any family. And also, unlike licensing fees, the death registration filing fee applies equally to all deaths, and as such, raising this fee constitutes the most equitable and straightforward means of generating additional revenue to support the board's programs. I should also add that when the legislature considered this new fee in 1985, they successfully diminished the problem associated with allocating the fee burden equally by establishing the death certificate filing fee. And I have checked historically, and when the fee was first established in 1985, it was generating between 55% and 60% of the board's revenue. As time has gone by, that figure has changed. If we were to raise licensing fees instead of the death certificate filing fee, the share of the board's revenue coming from the death certificate filing fee would drop to about 25%. In increasing the death certificate filing fee, we get back to relatively the same proportion that was in existence in 1985.
Representative March, did you hear a response in that detail to your question?
I never did find out what the licensing fee were for the various categories, but I imagine you can submit that data if you don't have it readily handled.
All right. We'll move on to Representative Tootie Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the establishment of this board purpose is to monitor itself for the perpetuation of its own profession?
Well, there's...
And public safety. But it's also for the, to perpetuate your own business interests.
Representative Smith, it's my view that the mission of the board is to protect the public health, safety, and welfare through the performance of the legislatively mandated licensing, inspection, complaint investigation, background inspection duties that it performs. There was a time, this board has been in existence since about 1921, and it was then the funeral director and embalmer's board. I think it may be fair to say that when the board got started way back when, it was similar to other sorts of licensing boards, and there was a guild-like mentality in terms of licensing and changed since 1985.
That's fine, but what I'm getting at, because you take the public safety's welfare in such high esteem or and high priority, it also looks good on the profession. So I'm wondering why, with your fee increase, then why is the public the one to bear for your fee increase when maybe you could have done, you know, a little bit on each of your licensing fees? That's my only. I heard everything that you said, but I guess I'm not totally convinced that we need to double the death certificate. When I read in here, business is booming, so to speak. And
well, can I address that?
Yeah.
Representative Smith, business is not booming, and there is a decrease in the financial aspects of funeral service and cemeteries. We're looking more at a decrease in revenues due to the fact that more and more people are doing cremation. There's probably a between 62% and 65% cremation here in Oregon now. That means that the traditional service has decreased drastically, and we have what is also called immediate disposition companies that are like a cut rate business, curbstone business that sets up a small little business somewhere, and sometimes they're operated out of a residence with a telephone number and everything. They thereby extricate additional business from Oregonians by just giving a number, providing bare minimum services. And so facilities like ours, which is a very expensive building to operate, taxes and those kinds of things, create more of a burden on traditional funeral homes.
But at the same time, you know, it's well understood our population is aging, and we have more and more people who are in the category where death would seem to be coming sooner rather than later. So, and maybe some of those people are, you know, using cremation services over other type of services. But I just, for the record, that's why I have trouble with your fee increase.
Mr. Garcia and Representative Smith, just also for the record, I'm looking now at the report we have from our legislative fiscal analyst, Cindy Jones. There's a statement under the section titled Budget Environment that says the industry has experienced a 39% increase in the number of funeral establishments and immediate disposition companies over the past 16 years. This increase is compounded with a 25% increase in the death rate. So the statement in the fiscal analysis would seem to contradict what we're hearing from our witness, Mr. Garcia. Would you care to comment on this information?
Well, the industry has gone through quite a bit of change within the last 10 years. Most small funeral home operations are now owned by corporations, and when a corporation moves into a community, generally what they tend to do is walk in and create large expensive fee hikes to the consumer, and so thereby the smaller funeral home operator does not have the ability to compete with some of these people. You've probably read recently and within the last few years where some of these corporations, however, have gone through a real downsizing and created bankruptcy situations for themselves because of their practices, not only here in Oregon but throughout the nation. So, there's a variety of ways that you can look at the dollars and cents of a business. I don't know if that clarifies or enhances or, you know, makes heads or tails out of this situation here. But.
Well, from where I sit, frankly, the water's a little muddy.
Yeah, I would have to agree, Madam Chair. I'm not convinced a fee increase is necessary, and you really haven't made your case to me either. Thank you very much.
Mr. Coe, did you wish to continue?
Well, yes, if I might add a little concerning the fee and who bears the burden. Technically, under the law, it's the funeral service practitioner who first assumes custody of human remains who must pay the death certificate filing fee. As a practical matter, that filing fee is treated as what's known as a cash advance item, and it is passed directly on to the consumer. There's really not a whole lot of difference between passing that kind of a fee on to the consumer and raising licensing fees, which are obviously passed on to the consumer as well. So I don't want you to think that there's any real difference in terms of where the money's coming from. Obviously, the consumer is going to pay for one way or the other. Whether it's a death certificate filing fee or a license fee increase, both are going to have pressure on the upward cost of the final disposition.
Representative Smith.
Okay. Now, I don't mean to be argumentative here, but this gentleman just said that it's becoming more and more competitive in the marketplace, okay, which contradicts the statement that's in front of us here today. And if that's true, then necessary license fees may not be passed on to the consumer if cemetery or mortuary X decides, well, I don't think my community can here can bear the increased cost of a license fee right now. Maybe I'll wait till later. So what you're saying, I don't believe is totally necessarily logical as what, I mean, or as immediate as what this other would be, because I too am a business owner and I understand how those fees are done, because I would weigh each circumstance saying, well, I don't think I'm going to pass it on this year, maybe I'll wait till next year. So thank you.
As we leave the fee issue just for the moment, the fiscal analysis also points out that your fees have not been raised since 1993.
The license fees have not been raised since 1993, and the death certificate filing fee not since 85.
All right. Please continue.
Along the with respect to fees in comparison, I did do try to do some form of analysis between when I submitted this presentation and speaking to you now. It is rather difficult to compare Oregon's regulatory scheme and fee structure with those in other states, because other states are organized differently. In the state of Idaho, for instance, their regulatory board does not regulate cemeteries. But the one comparison that I did find that seemed to be more reasonable with respect to structure had to do with the state of California. They do regulate cemeteries and crematories and funeral homes just as Oregon does. The difference there is that their regulatory agency is a bureau. There is no board. There is no voluntary board at the head of the agency. It's a straight state agency. Mm-hmm. Just as a matter of comparison, I think this will show that while we believe the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board's efforts have been effective in protecting consumers, it's very modest relative to the regulatory scheme in California. California inspects 1,330 facilities. And they had been doing that with a total of six investigators. Oregon inspects 750 facilities, and we had two investigators. Recently, I think in September, the California legislature approved three additional investigator positions for California to bring their total to nine. And that would be nine inspectors for 1,330 facilities, while the board has two inspectors for 750. There's a dramatic difference there. One of the reasons that California legislature made the decision to increase its regulatory oversight had to do with a variety of troubles the industry has experienced. One example has to do with the Tri-State Crematory in Noble, Georgia, where 339, I believe, is the total count now, human remains were found to be abused in horrible ways by the owner of that crematory. And I think the principal reason, no one can imagine what was in the mind of the man who was responsible for that horrific incident, but it is clear from a regulatory perspective that had the facility been subject to regular inspection, the problem wouldn't have happened. And one of the things, when we look at complaint statistics and other things that we can't prove to you, is how many problems our efforts have prevented because we're out there inspecting facilities. If the board's fee increase is not approved, it will necessarily result in the elimination of one of only two investigator or inspector positions in the state of Oregon. And I think you can see that that sort of reduction would have a dramatic impact on the board's ability to investigate complaints and get out and inspect facilities. The simple fact that an inspector is going to show up and look around would have prevented the tragedy that occurred in Noble, Georgia.
Are there additional questions or comments regarding the board's operation? And just a reminder that we do have the fee bill as well following 5026. Representative Smith and then Senator Beverly.
This is just to be real quick, and you can bring back the information to me later because I'm sure you have an answer. What if we chose to raise your fees $3 to make it an even $10, and the rest of the increase would go on licensees? What would how much would that be per license, and then how much would you bring back in that total? So maybe if we could break it up a little bit, you know, $10 fee to me does not sound bad. And the percentage of increase does not sound near as bad, and but then kind of distribute it to both ways. Could you do that for me?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Meserle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. The first is, I thought I heard you say that at present proposed budget, without a fee increase, that you would only have $40,000 left in your ending balance. But I am looking at, if I'm looking at the right figure here, your budget proposes a $284,000 ending balance or beginning balance, and that would be about 6 months. Am I looking at the wrong figures here?
Senator Meserle, it would be at the end of the 03-05 biennium. If the board maintained the current staffing level, by the end of the 03-05 biennium, we would be $40,000 in the hole and have no cash balance.
And where would I find that? Is that in our documents?
It's in the budget support documents, I'm sure. And they are at the back of your budget binder.
Well, I think I found it myself on, I'm not sure what page it is. Page 149. Second question, there's a tremendous drop in complaints. How do you account for that? What caused that?
A drop in complaints?
In investigations and complaints. You've gone from 249 in 99-201 to actual 201-203 to 120. And I noticed in your proposals you're expecting 170, I believe.
The aberration, I believe the aberration you're referring to has to do with one case. That has to do with a funeral home in Brookings, Oregon, that changed ownership, then went bankrupt, and after the bankruptcy, it came to the board's attention that the owner had taken pre-need trust money, had entered into contracts with families to provide funeral services, failed to deposit the money, and those families who have been impacted by that have come to the board and filed complaints, and I think there were 100 separate complaints from individuals based on that one funeral home. A number of those people have already applied to the Consumer Protection Trust Fund, which is administered by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and have obtained reimbursement for their loss, but the board has received this number of complaints on that one particular case, and it therefore has the impact of warping both the number of complaints received and the number of complaints we expect to resolve. But other than that, there has been some minor fluctuation, but I don't think it's, I think that's the major aberration that you're observing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Let me stop you right here, Mr. Cohen, ask members of the committee if there are any particular questions or comments related to the performance measures for this particular board. Then could we go to your Senate Bill 786 report,
sure.
Mr. Coe?
As you know, this diversity measure was designed to encourage people of color and bilingual people to participate in health professional regulatory boards and to take up careers in health-related professions. Obviously, the Mortuary and Cemetery Board is not health-related in the same sense that the Dentistry Board and others might be, but nevertheless, it is considered by definition a health-related licensing board, and it also has the same sorts of impacts that any other health-related licensing board might have. Senate Bill 786 also requires health-related health professional regulatory boards to maintain records of the racial and ethnic makeup of applicants and licensed professionals. Senate Bill 786 became effective January 1, 2002. In preparation for implementation, the board participated in planning sessions with other health professional regulatory boards in the hope of developing uniform data collection procedures. I think I've listened to a couple of other presentations on legislative audio, and I know that you've heard of a calendar of events and planning sessions, and the board also participated in those. Anyway, the board's renewal cycle, just by coincidence, was coming up in November of 2001, and it was clear that that due date would pass before any consensus could be achieved among all the health-related licensing boards for how to collect this data. So rather than wait until the next renewal cycle, the board decided to go ahead on its own to reconfigure its licensing database and to begin gathering data. Nearly 500 active licensees completed the survey, and there is a table of the results on page 7 of my written presentation to the subcommittee. I also felt it was perhaps worth noting that of 11 current members on the board, one is of Hispanic origin and another is Filipino. Also, quite a while before passage of Senate Bill 786, the board had an African-American president for a two-year period covering 1998 and 1999. Also, the board hired its first African-American investigator in April of 2000. Unfortunately, about a year and a half with the board, he was promoted to another position in state government. I'm a member of the Funeral Service Education Advisory Committee at Mount Hood Community College, and I had the opportunity to make several presentations to that particular group. And in a sense, it has the advantage of being able to expand importance of this diversity initiative to other states, because others on the board come from states like Idaho and Washington and other states that border Oregon and states that Mount Hood Community College serves. in a setting that was unrelated to Mount Hood, I successfully recruited an African-American woman from Portland who is now a licensed apprentice funeral service practitioner. I just spoke with her last week. Our law requires a funeral service practitioner to have an associate's degree. This young woman does not have an associate's degree, and she has a four-year window that she can employ her apprenticeship, but after that period she needs to become licensed, and that will require her to have an associate's degree. And so I've been encouraging her to get her associate's degree, and it's my understanding that she's actively considering enrollment in Mount Hood's program. I also received a call recently from an African-American woman from Florida who was interested in moving to Oregon and completing her embalming education. She had started her education at one point and had to interrupt it because of family illness, and she also was concerned about costs and money matters. And I called Bill Malcolm, who's the director of the Funeral Service Education Program at Mount Hood, and put him in contact with the woman, and he was also able to identify some national scholarship opportunities that she might be able to take advantage of. The board expressed its support for Senate Bill 786 in the form of a formal objective under Goal 3 to promote programs designed to increase the representation of people of color and bilingual people on the board within the death care profession. I didn't include it in my presentation, but on a personal level, I'd like to express my support for this initiative based upon 20 years of prior civil rights enforcement experience. And I just want you to know that the board is very much in support of Senate Bill 786.
Mr. Coe, thank you very much for that testimony, and also Mr. Garcia. Are there any other questions for Mr. Garcia or Mr. Coe before we ask Mr. Jeremy Patton for his walkthrough of the DAS budget, please? Oh, let me close the hearing, please. I don't think we have anyone. We don't have anyone signed up. Okay.
But you're okay to keep the hearing open. We don't close the hearing until we're all done.
Okay. We'll keep the hearing open on House Bill 5026, and we will open a hearing on House Bill 5038, which is the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board fee bill. I'll note for the record that we've had quite a bit of discussion under the previous bill about the fee structure, and if the committee is comfortable going right to Mr. Patton's report, we can do that. Thank you. Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Patton with the Department of Administrative Services. My presentation should be on the desk in front of you. If you go ahead and turn to page 2, this shows that the board is $1,136,897 other funds with 6 full-time physicians. Page 3 shows that the board is 100% other funds. Page 4, the governor's budget continues the current level of service to its licensees and citizens. The board has no enhancement packages to add to their budget, and the budget does include the preneed salesperson renewal fee and the death certificate filing fee. Page 5 shows that the board is one program unit. Page 6 is a breakout of personal services and supplies. Personal services is about 69%. Services and supplies is about 31%. The next page shows the board did not attend any emergency boards during the interim. The only adjustment was for the compensation plan in the third special session. Package 010 contains standard inflation for temporary appointments, which is 3.5%, plus a decrease in mass transit tax. The board did phase out the startup cost to implement the pre-need salesperson renewal requirements, and these requirements were stated in House Bill 2809 from last session. Page 8, the inflation is a standard inflation of 3.5% for facilities rent. The package also includes $6,761 in facilities rent for reconciliation of space in the Portland State Office Building. As far as policy packages, Package 070 is a revenue shortfall package. This package would eliminate one full-time investigator, two position. Package 171 contains the revenues from the death registration fee increase and restore the investigator two position. Package 173 is the revenue gain from the pre-need salesperson registration renewal, which is about $8,200. Package 9 shows some quick detail about the fee and revenue changes, and the only technical adjustment is the elimination of the impact of the merit increases. If there are any questions.
Questions or comments for Mr. Patton? Thank you very much. Thank you to all of you, and I believe we're at a place now where we can close the hearing on House Bill 5038. And we will also adjourn our committee, and we'll see everyone tomorrow.